You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brent Simpson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have two of my favorite authors on the show today, Nikki Girard and Sean French, who write together collectively as Nikki French. And if you are a thriller, a crime fiction lover like I am, then you know exactly who Nikki French are. And I'm sure that you have a number of their books on your bookshelf, like I do. Welcome back to the show, guys.
Lovely to be here.
We're really pleased to be here. Thank you for having us.
I'm super excited. You know, we were just talking before we came on the air that this is something I look forward to each year, and I consider you guys part of the Author Stories family. And, you know, even though we talk once a year or so, probably, it's just fun to catch up and to see what's going on in the corner. In your corner of the world each year.
Well, we feel just the same.
We're glad.
You know, we were talking for a second recording about 2020 and this weird year that's been going on. And I talked to a lot of authors, and I've gotten some interesting feedback from them, because, you know, authors are a strange sort. Usually we tend to spend most of our working hours alone in an office and with our computers or our notepads or whatever it is, and, you know, collecting thoughts. And so we're not necessarily a social group, you know, during working hours. We'll just put it that way. But something strange has been going on in 2020, especially with a global pandemic and lockdowns and all of that. And whereas you would think that authors wouldn't necessarily be affected from this because of the nature of the way we work, it's been affecting people differently. How about you two? What has this situation we're going through? What is it? Has it made any differences in the way you work or how you approach storycraft?
Well, it's been a bit complicated. I think because, as you say, in a certain, it's just we live. Nikki and I live in lockdown all the time,
right.
And we were able to carry. We sort of carried on writing in certain ways. And actually, for me, Nikki will say something in a minute, maybe. But personally, the first 4 months or so, we had all our family around us. We live in this quite big house out in the countryside, and there were nine of us, and for 4 months. We were just locked in, and there was a kind of adrenaline about it. It was quite exciting, and, you know, it was complicated and emotional, but quite exciting. And I think for me, and I think this is true of a lot of people over here in the UK, it's almost the hard bit is now when it started to fall apart and people aren't quite sure what the rules are, and we feel, can we go on for another year like this? You know, so I think that now, so it's been a real roller coaster, actually.
Also, I feel immensely conscious that, you know, me and Sean, we're one of the lucky ones. You know, we still have our work. We have a lovely house to live in. We don't have the anxieties and the terrors that so many people are having at the moment. Nevertheless, there is a sense of a dread in the world, I think, or something, you know, maybe anxiety, maybe dread is too big a word for it. But it's very hard not to feel that and not to be aware of suddenly how vulnerable everybody is and how precarious people's lives are. And that has, you know, if you're a kind of sentient human being, that has to affect you. That has to affect the way you're thinking about yourself in the world.
Also, I'll say one more thing. Nikki and sure. I, we made this vow a few months ago that we're absolutely not going to write a COVID thriller. I think publishers and agents around the world must be dreading all the people sitting around writing their stories about group of people who are sort of suddenly locked in for COVID and suddenly someone's murdered and who did it, you know. I think we're, one of the things about us is I think we're going to not want to read lots of books about COVID and see lots of films about COVID in the next 2 years.
So on the other hand, but I think it would be very strange if writers kind of weren't affected in the way that they wrote by what's happened. How can we not be? But how that will then work itself into what they write, that's anybody's guess. It'll probably come in strange ways.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, do you feel like, you know, some of the things we're experiencing will seep into your writing? And I absolutely agree with you, Sean. I don't want to see a COVID lockdown thriller, but it does make me wonder if we won't see coded messages, if you want to put it that way, seep into storytelling. And you know, is this scenario that we're reading, is this just what we've experienced couched in a different kind of story? It's going to be interesting to me to see, you know, how people process this, because we all process things through our writing. I mean, I don't think there's any secret to that. But it's going to be interesting to see if people are able to pull it off and in a way that's palatable to readers, because nobody wants to relive 2020. I'll tell you that.
That is certainly true. And that thing about kind of that kind of collective trauma that we're all living through,
yeah. All
the kind of the sense of our own vulnerability, which we might not have faced up to before, or the sense of the body being dangerous and contagious, the kind of prohibition on touch, I mean, who knows how that will come about. Our agent actually told us that one of the things that publishers were receiving, along with COVID novels, was Zoom novels.
I've seen a couple of those already.
But more in a way, to think of, I mean, to go slightly out of our genre, think of the whole craze in the last decade or so for zombie things, like, you know, like The Walking Dead. And in a way, I think what COVID has been a bit like that, that we've suddenly seen how fragile our society, how the world we live in is. You know, things have just failed. And what happens when normal, you know, when we can't go out and when we can't interact and when, you know, when there's something invisible in the air, you know, I think that we don't want to literally write COVID novels, but I think people are going to see life differently. Yeah, I think, as you were saying.
Like you mentioned, the things, you know, over the last decade or so, zombie novels for sure. But there's also been a kind of a glut of YA post-apocalyptic novels, or the genre is just escaping me, where, you know, kind of the future of society and how society breaks down. It's going to be interesting to see how people process that. And another thing that I've noticed is that over the last few years, there have been a tremendous amount of World War II historical fiction that's come out, and some really, really great books have come out. But World War II was, you know, 80 years ago or so.
Yeah,
I'm doing the math off the top of my head. And, you know, one, that's most of the people that are writing that now weren't even alive then, and maybe had grandparents that were alive then. But there's something about getting far enough away from an event that we're afraid of losing those stories. And it seems like writers collectively start, you know, there's kind of a buzz around it again. And I wonder if there won't be a generation or two that looks back at COVID and says, wow, I hope we could do that better if that ever happens again. And maybe some stories come out of that.
Well, I think that's right. I think it takes time.
And that's so interesting, because the World War II movies and stories that have been coming out, it seems to me that that's a lot of that's about you. I'm sure you're right about hanging on to stories, but also you can couch that in heroic terms, people doing the right thing. I mean, at the moment with COVID, there are lots of very unheroic things that are going on, aren't there? And it's like about mess and uncertainty. And it's, you know, we're in it, so we can't see the shape of it. We're just pressed up against it in all its uncertainty and grimness.
And we don't know how it's going to end.
And the one thing about World War II is that there was a bad guy that you could point to, you know, and of course there was all sorts of gray issues, you know, in World War II, obviously there were, but there was, it was more of an us versus them sort of feeling. And COVID is not like that at all. There's really no boogeyman over in the corner that we can all, you know, gang up to try to take on.
Well, some people disagree, of course. We've got the China virus.
True.
But even that's interesting, because that's an example how we we have this impulse to try and find someone to blame. It's really hard.
And we talk about it in the language of war, don't we? Kind of fighting this battle. But is it, I mean, I think the kind of the whole thing about kind of climate change and kind of despoilation of the natural world comes close to that, which is like kind of apocalyptic times, because there is a sense that the world, nature is almost turning, you know, we've done so many bad things to it, and now it's turning against us.
Exactly. It's going to be interesting to watch. We'll just put it that way. Well, you guys have a new book out, House of Correction. How many novels does this make for you now that come to market?
Of a number. I've lost count years ago.
This is our 23rd Nikki French novel. And before saying anything else about it, we've sworn not to write a coronavirus novel. But in a sense, this is written. We wrote it long before COVID-19 was even a kind of shadow on the horizon. But this is our lockdown novel.
Well, you know, that's another thing that's come up is that we see stories that are coming out that, like you said, were written long before this happened. But it's almost like the things we're going through, we had already feared about, or we had already had trepidation over, you know, what would happen if these sorts of things happen. It's interesting to see those things come to light as well.
Well, we knew it was coming, actually. Nikki and I actually I don't know why we did this, is out of some masochism, but last night we watched the Steven Soderbergh movie Contagion, which was made in 2011 and is about a pandemic. And it is one of the most eerily prescient works of art I've ever seen. It's talking, you know, this film that's talking about R numbers and social distancing and, you know, and the kinds of panic and of trying to get people wearing masks. It was really, you know, that's one of the strange things, which I think one of these people will look back on. So we seem to have drifted back into COVID.
Last
thing I'll say is I think one of the people would look back in is that it would be an example of, we knew it, everyone knew it was coming. The scientists didn't know, the epidemiologists have not in the last 10 years, we're not saying, oh, it might happen. They're all saying it's only a question of when it happens. And it's fast. I think lots of writers have been, there's been something in the air, because there's been a feeling of dread, I think, for the last 10, 15, 20 years.
So I know that you guys have an interesting way of working together. And I've met co-writers who literally sit side by side at a desk, and they're hovered over one computer, and, you know, one person is pointing out, oh, type this, and, you know, the other, you know, creates a sentence, and they're kind of editing together, and it's an interesting way of putting two heads together. But I know that you guys don't work that way, and I think there's a video on YouTube, Nikki, where you show off your writing space, which is at the top of your house. And I think at one point you say, you know, this is as far from Sean's writing shed as a guy could physically get.
It's true.
So you guys have your own writing spaces, and you trade the manuscript back and forth. Has this lockdown area or this lockdown era that we're going through, has that affected the way that you work together?
No. We could still have to get as far away as possible. I mean, actually, we are together when we plan the book, and so we do, just at the moment we're planning our next book, and that's very much sitting in the same room. And I can definitely say that I've got a great capacity to get on Nikki's nerves when we're in the same room, and that's just talking. So if you were writing, I mean, he's writing.
That makes me sound terrible. Yeah, I'm the one to blame. He's very distracted.
Talking is one thing, and that's really important. You know, that's when we're like free associating and just talking about structure and plans and ideas. And that's really, I mean, in a way, that's great. Then it's really great. I think we can bounce off each other. And you have to, if you have an idea, you have to justify it to the other person. But writing, I don't understand how people can write sitting next to each other, because it's so raw. And also, you have to be really free to be on your own and crazy and not think of someone, you know, not have the idea that someone else is going to read it. And that, but then of course, that's the strange thing is you know, writing something and it's slightly unformed and sending it to someone, sending it to Nikki, who's free to then just change and alter it. So, I mean, you know, as you said, we've done 23 books and I find it as bizarre. I still don't understand how we do it, you know, really.
I'm glad you brought that up, Sean, because, you know, one piece of writing advice that a lot of people give is to turn off the internal editor and just write freely, because you can go back and edit, you know, but you can't edit a page that doesn't have any words on it. And there's something naturally that comes with someone looking over your shoulder. You're going to second guess yourself, or you're not going to put down that sentence that maybe you only salvage two words of, but something is alive in that sentence, but you'll never get that if someone's looking over your shoulder. So
that's certainly true for us. And that kind of, it would be very self-conscious and awkward and on the surface act. And I think in kind of writing, it's more about sinking down into kind of the mysterious swamps of the self, if you like, and seeing what you find there. And also daring to fail and be messy and look ridiculous.
Mm. And also going, yes, and being intimate and being embarrassing and saying things that are, you know, not polite. You know, all of those things you've got to, you know. And I think if you were just, I think at that point, we did one time when we did our first book, we thought we'd celebrate by writing the last chapter together. And it was a disaster. We started arguing and we became very self-conscious about each sentence. So I think
sentence was a very inadequate, meager kind of sentence that had no roots into anything. So never again.
The Novel Factory Online is software for the serious writer. With features like notes that are automatically organized, that means no more drowning in piles of paper, notes, or spending hours organizing digital folder structures. The Novel Factory offers clear, obvious structures for noting down information about plot, characters, locations, and everything else relating to your novel. Innovative features like the roadmap take you from concept to finished novel. The roadmap is an optional step-by-step guide to writing a novel that takes you from the premise to final manuscript and beyond. It draws on tried and true, tested theory that lies behind the majority of best-selling novels and blockbuster movies. Access your writing anywhere. The web version of the Novel Factory can be accessed anywhere you have internet. So you can write your novel on the train to work, while walking the dog, or climbing a mountain. Just log in and all your drafts and notes will be at your fingertips. Go to novel-writer.com to see how this powerful software can unleash your creative side. Use code HANK2020 for 20% off. That's the Novel Factory.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.
I'm amazed at people that can write together, and your creative process together creates stunning work. And
I just have to say, that's very kind of you. But also, if I could go back in a time machine 30 years and tell myself that I would be, my main thing, I'd be writing with, you know, I'd be writing novels with Nikki, and that she'd be just rewriting everything I did. I thought that is what alternative universe that I blundered into.
So the last time we talked, Frida Kline was over. One of the best characters in recurring fiction that I know of. Frida was this amazing force of nature, almost that occupied 7 novels by you guys. With House of Correction, all of that shorthand that is built into having a recurring character who occupies a world that's already built and has, you know, a cast of supporting characters around her, all that's off. All bets are off, and the slate is completely clean. Where did House of Correction, where did the first idea for this story come from?
It's really interesting. Often the basic idea is very simple and very, almost abstract. We sometimes like to set ourselves a certain kind of challenge. We say, what if we did this? Could we get away with this? And the simple abstract idea for House of Correction was we thought of a woman having to solve a crime, but the problem of to find out who committed a murder, but with the great problem that she is in prison, charged with that murder. So she'd have to be a detective, but not able to do any of the things that normal detectives do, like going and visiting the crime scene, going and interviewing suspects. She'd have to really almost do it in her own head. And we were sort of intrigued by that, just as almost as an intellectual exercise. So that was the beginning.
And of course, it changed from that. She's in prison, kind of locked in her cell much of the time, locked in with her own thoughts. She does, people come to visit her, so she does interview them. She gets hold of CCTV so she can look at films. And then we do break her out of prison in order to allow her to go into the court. Well,
not break her out.
We don't break her. We break her out. She doesn't break her out. But we do break her out. We know. It's almost a novel in 3 acts. The first act is of her being in prison in the depths of despair and helpless. The second act is her being in prison fighting for herself and fighting both to get herself out of prison, but also to get herself to rescue herself from herself, if you like. And the third act is a kind of courtroom drama when she has to defend herself in court.
Because we met that in, one of the things we also thought about for this book is Tabitha, the main character. We wanted to start her at absolute rock bottom and then make things worse for her. You know, and there she is, accused of murder, deeply depressed, can't even remember if she may have done the murder. And then she discovers her own defense, her own lawyer doesn't believe her, thinks she did it. And so she then, in a kind of fit of madness, fires her lawyer and elects to defend herself, which is generally a very, very bad idea. And then she, at that complete low point, she has to try and come out from the dark into the light.
And we wanted to write a novel that was both very harrowing. I mean, she's depressed, she's in prison, she's charged with murder. Things couldn't be worse. And yet we wanted also to have a novel that is full of kind of energy and zest. So we have our main character, Tabitha. Although she's a depressive, she's also stubborn kind of fighter character. She's like a witch and an outsider, and she's a loose cannon. And so we kind of put her inside these very kind of tight settings, a prison, a theatrical formal courtroom, and then we let her run amok, if you like.
There's an old saying, and I'm going to butcher it, I'm sure, because I'm not going to look it up while we're talking, but something to the effect of, the person that decides to defend themselves in court has a fool for a lawyer or something to that effect. Something to that effect. When you say that you start her on in a bad situation and then only make things worse for her, was that a challenge to think of, to take this very vulnerable character and and just do the worst things to her and then, you know, set her up for what seems to be utter failure.
Well, if I were going to give, advice to anyone thinking, especially if you're writing thrillers, but I think it applies to almost all kinds of fictional storytelling. There's a real danger as you create, Tabitha, we kind of, by the end, can't speak for readers, but Nikki and I, we fell in love with her as a character. And you do sort of love your characters. And there's a real danger that you think, oh, they're like your children and you want to make it easy for them and give them a good time. And, you're creating drama, and what you have to do is throw obstacles, obstacle after obstacle in your beloved character's way, and just make things difficult for them. Sometimes you can feel like a real cruel, vengeful god, like tormenting this person. But sometimes it felt terrible, this poor woman, and we were making things worse and worse. But it was crucial to the story.
But also at the same time, going alongside that or kind of following on from that. So we did kind of. There are lots of impediments that we put in Tabitha's way. And she does rise to the occasion, I would say. But also, we envisaged it by the end as a novel that's about recovery, about her own recovery. So we, at the beginning, she's someone who's deeply damaged by things that have happened to her in her past and deeply locked into herself. And partly the novel is about her fighting to get free of that. So we hope that, like us, the reader will be kind of cheering her along the way by the end.
I've heard someone say before that you should take your character, stick them in a tree, and then set the tree on fire.
Alfred Hitchcock said the secret of doing a thriller was to take a beautiful woman and make her suffer.
Well, and he was absolutely right. What is it about, taking a character to the depths of despair? Why do we as readers, why do we lock on to stories like that? Why are we intrigued by watching someone suffer? Or is it not the suffering, but the hope of the overcoming the suffering that we're looking for?
Well, I think it's both of those things. There is something... in a way, it's a bit like, why do small children like stories that are about witches and dark forests and ghouls and ghosts? There's something about, we go to fiction for to show people having the extremes. So we all of us feel sadness or fear. And there's something about reading about characters or having that, and the dial is turned up to 11 in that, and you see them really experiencing everything. So, there's a kind of, for us in this story here, it is to take Tabitha, and she has to go to find the absolute limit of what she can survive, where she can come back from. And then, of course, in a way that makes it more, to get back to the idea in the courtroom. So it's not only her being on trial for her, facing the possibility of a life and lifetime being convicted of murder and spending the rest of her life in prison, but having to, when we made her, so she's actually defending herself. So she has to go into this incredibly complex ritualistic world of the British justice system and navigate it, that feels like a sort of, you're constantly raising the stakes for the character. The British justice system is so kind of pompous and ritualistic and theatrical. There's a kind of comedy of throwing in a character who just doesn't know the rules and keeps breaking them constantly, while somehow just getting by.
Also, don't you think there's something about, I've so much kind of underneath the calm surface that we've made for ourselves, and when extreme things happen, that surface gets split, and so you see into the heart of people, you see what people are like underneath that decorous surface.
Absolutely. I think I know enough about you guys to know that neither one of you are lawyers or barristers, as you guys might say, and you've never done time in a women's prison. How do you so believably paint this landscape and draw out all of the little details that make this so believable? What did you guys do to prepare for a story like this?
Yes, so we did. So I think the answer to that is research and then imagination. So we have over the years gone into a lot of prisons and done kind of book groups and talked to the prisoners there, both men's prisons and women's prisons. So we know just only from the outside, from walking in and then being able to walk out again, something of what it feels like.
I mean, it's terrifying to be just in a prison, to visit.
Just as a visitor, it is a really grimly terrifying experience. And then with the trial,
so that was really an inspiration for the book as well.
We wanted to write about those worlds which are very hidden. They're there. I mean, we live in our place in London. It's right, the road that we live on also has one of the big prisons, and it's just there in this middle class pleasant area. There is this big prison where terrible things are going on, and we wanted to write about that. That hidden world of terror right in our midst. So there was that. And then also the trial. Well, you know, as a journalist, I've covered some big trials. And then when we were researching this book, we went to the Old Bailey quite a few times and sat through trials. I'm afraid we never found a trial where anyone was defending themselves against the charge of murder, because that is very rare for a good reason.
And we did. I think we got to a point where we could almost have stood up and represented a client ourselves. We really studied the rules, because if Tabitha's going to break the rules and stumble over them, we felt we really had to get the procedures right.
Absolutely. A strange thing happens along the way in this story where all of the fear and the kind of the seeing the inner workings of this criminal justice system is that the reader starts to develop a sort of empathy for the characters and the situation. Was that something that you kind of predicted for yourselves from the beginning, that we would this would be an expose of sorts of, maybe not necessarily the failings of the system and how, people navigate that, but that we would connect so closely and deeply with these characters and what goes on in situations like this?
Oh, wow. Oh, absolutely. I mean, people in prison, they're people. And often we like to dehumanize and therefore be able to ignore people in prison. They're people, and mostly they're people who are poor and who've had a really bad deal in life. And there they are, and then they're horribly punished. And, you know, the prison system in the UK is scandalous, I think, and far too many people are in prison. And in women's prisons, far too many women are in women's prison, because mostly they're not a danger to other people. They're more a danger to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, with Tabitha, we wanted to take someone who's like a difficult, at the beginning, is a difficult, awkward character to like, and gradually we hope that people would kind of come to like her or love her. But always the main thing is that you want it to be an absolutely gripping story, and trying to find, did Tabitha do it? And if she didn't do it, who could have done it? Because it does seem that no one else could have. But by the way, part of what we hope is gripping about it, people come away feeling there is something, the horror of what we subject people to in prison is kind of terrible work in our society that we try not to think about. And also the terrible failings of the justice system, which I think applies, actually, in this particular specific thing, I think is even worse in the United States than in Britain, which is where prosecutors actually almost force innocent people, or possibly innocent people, to plead guilty by threatening them, saying, well, if you plead, if you plead guilty now, you'll get a very shorter sentence, whereas if you go to trial and get convicted and take the risk of getting convicted, you'll get a life sentence. And that form that, so which there's often a terrible temptation for innocent people to plead guilty, because the risk is so high of what happens if things go wrong in court. And so we want it to, and that becomes a matter, we hope, of suspense in the book about, there is a constant temptation for Tabitha just to plead guilty, because the risks of not of being convicted are so high. But lots of people face that in the justice system.
Well, and before people get the idea that this is just a heady treatise on you know, the state of criminal justice. This is a fantastically entertaining read that you will be flying through the pages trying to figure out what happens next. When you're dealing with a character like Tabitha, who is a little bit unlikable, you know, in the beginning, and you said your goal was to make readers fall in love with her along her journey. How do you deal with risking losing the reading audience by making her so kind of precarious and in the beginning before you can build that love for her? How do you hook the readers into going along for the ride with a character they may not like from the beginning?
Well, I like Tabitha from the very beginning. She's difficult, but I think kind of she's her own person at huge costs. You know, she's her own worst enemy as well. And she's very vulnerable and she's an outsider. And I think that people can put up with a lot in their characters if they believe in them and if they can feel somehow intimately connected to them and kind of come to understand that. I think she's kind of prickly and stubborn and not ingratiating at all. But I think that makes her just lovely, really. I want to bring her home and sit her by the fire and give her rice pudding.
Well, except we didn't. Unfortunately, we gave her a much harder time. I mean, I would say that there's something about, you know, we create this character and gradually everyone is against her and she doesn't give up. She's a fighter and there's something attractive. I think in the way you're on the side, you know, someone who just won't lie down and will, you know, and she won't give in. And I think gradually you just, as she, finds the kind of resources going into this court, you know, halfway through the book with everyone against her. And it seems like there's no way through. And I feel we feel that something we want to, you know, we want to be on someone's side like that. I hope.
Yeah, she kind of represents the powerless against the powerful.
I think that's a great way to sum it up. The new book is called House of Correction, a fantastic read. If you are looking for a thriller, you know, for some of these sort of gloomy fall evenings that we see ourselves settling into, this is a book that you must have on your bedside reading table. House of Correction. Available everywhere today. Happy launch day, Nikki and Sean.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I know you guys said that you're starting on a new book here and you're kind of in that brainstorming phase. Is there another book in the chute for coming out soon?
Yeah, we've finished the book After House of Correction. You want us to say something about it, or is that
absolutely easy? Give us a taste.
I could see the starting idea of this book, we're not quite sure of the title yet. But what it's about is it's about a woman who's got a 3-year-old. She's recently separated from her partner, and she's got a 3-year-old daughter. And this little girl comes back from play school, and she's done a drawing which suggests that she's witnessed a crime. It seems to be a drawing of a murder, but the mother can't find out where there doesn't seem to have been a murder. So the question is it just a drawing, or is there a real crime? And a spoiler alert: being a Nikki French book, there is a real crime.
I love it. I cannot wait for that one to come out, and I know you guys will join me again to talk about that book when it comes out. We'll look forward to it. House of Correction, available everywhere now. There's a link to it in the show notes of this episode. Sean and Nikki, where can people find you online if they want to dig into your massive back catalog and dig through all the great stuff that you guys have done?
Well, the easiest way is just we're on Twitter. And then you can find everything through Twitter.
Excellent. We'll put links there to that as well. Nikki and Sean, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show with me today.
Thank you. That was a real pleasure.
Lovely to talk to you again. Next year. Do you want to get paid to write stories? Do
Do you enjoy collaborating with other talented storytellers? Do you want to work completely remotely and set your own hours? Relay Publishing is looking for writers and editors to work on fiction projects across a range of genres, from thrillers to sci-fi, fantasy, and romance. The Relay process is extremely collaborative, in the same vein as a TV show's writer's room. If you're a story geek, then you'll be on a great team. There are 7 ghostwriting positions and 10 editing positions currently available. Please go to www.recruitment.relaypub.com. That's www.recruitment.relaypub.com for more information on how to apply. Join a great storytelling team today. What Death Taught Terrence by Derek McFadden. Life is a journey. So is the afterlife. At the end of his life, Terrence McDonald must discover its meaning or he'll be banned from the afterlife forever, and his soul will cease to exist. Join Terrence and those who love him on a poignant and unforgettable journey through a life at once wonderful and harrowing. Learn what Terrence learned. See what Terrence sees. By this provocative story's end, readers may even learn a thing or two about themselves. See why people are saying things like, "Derek McFadden writes with an insight you can match." If you like the works of Mitch Albom, I think you'll find What Death Taught Terrence a worthy addition to your library, and the reading of it a life-affirming journey. I found the story immediately immersive, and it stuck with me long after I finished. What Death Taught Terrence by Derek McFadden, on sale now. Invasion Day, the first book in the They Came for Blood series, by Scott Moon. David Osage is a dangerous man with a complicated past, but these days he's just trying to keep his head down, driving big rigs. One night he saddles himself with a hitchhiker, a nuisance who's more than she seemed, and that's when everything changes. No one was ready for an alien invasion. Death is raining from the sky, and the only questions left is, do you run, fight, or submit? For David Osage and his family, answering is as easy as giving the alien invaders the finger. Grab Book 1, Invasion Day, in the They Came for Blood series, and then follow it up with Book 2, Resistance Day, and Book 3, Victory Day. Available at Amazon.com.